When I get numb, I add the cold, and I sit down on the floor and I let the water run over my body and soothe the burns. The burning is tiring, and the cold tires me more. I close my eyes and I let my body shut itself down, and I let my mind wander. It wanders to a familiar place, a place I don't talk about or acknowledge exists, a place where there is only me, a place that I hate. I am alone. Alone here and alone in the world. Alone in my heart and alone in my mind. Alone everywhere. All the time, for as long as I can remember. Alone with my family. Alone with my friends. Alone in a room full of people. Alone when I wake. Alone through each awful day. Alone when I finally meet the blackness. I am alone in my horror. Alone in my horror. I don't want to be alone. I have never wanted to be alone. I fucking hate it. I hate that I have no one to talk to. I hate that I have no one to call. I hate that I have no one to hold my hand, hug me, tell me everything is going to be all right. I hate that I have no one to share my hopes and my dreams with. I hate that I no longer have any hopes or dreams. I hate that I have no one to tell me to hold on, that I can find them again. I hate that when I scream, and I scream bloody murder, that I am screaming into emptiness. I hate that there is no one to hear my scream, and that there is no one to help me learn how to stop screaming. I hate that what I have turned to in my loneliness lives in a pipe or a bottle. I hate that what I have turned to in my loneliness is killing me, has already killed me, or will kill me soon. I hate that I will die alone. I will die alone in my horror. More than anything, all I have ever wanted is to be close to someone. More than anything, all I have ever wanted is to feel as if I wasn't alone. I've tried many times. Tried to kill my loneliness with a girl or a woman, and it was never right. We would be together and be close to each other, but no matter how close we were, I still felt alone. They felt that loneliness, and it made them want to get closer. When they tried, I either ran or did something to destroy what we felt for each other. I can run fast when I want to run fast, and I've always been good at destroying things. Not one of them would be willing to speak to me today. The last one was the only one who made me feel the way I always wanted to feel. She made me feel better than I have ever felt, better than I imagined I could feel, and it scared me to the point of paralysis. When she offered herself to me, I failed. That failure drove me to destruction. I destroyed her, destroyed me, destroyed the two of us together. I destroyed the hope of a future. She will not speak my name now, nor will she acknowledge my existence. I don't blame her. I start talking to an old friend, an old dear friend. I say, "Hello, how are you? How have you been doing? What's new?" My voice reverberates in the shower and I feel stupid, but I keep talking. I say, "I miss you. I wish you were here. My friend's name is Michelle, and I haven't seen or spoken to her in over a decade. I say, you've been on my mind lately. I say, I may see you soon. I say, please be there when I arrive. I'm looking forward to spending some time together. It's been too long. Over a decade. It has been far too long." I met Michelle when I was 12, and my family had just moved to a small town. I had spent my entire life in a big city, and the adjustment wasn't smooth. I didn't relate to any of the kids in the town. They didn't relate to me. I didn't lift weights. I hated heavy metal. I thought working on cars was a waste of fucking time. At first, I made an effort to fit in, but I couldn't pretend, and after a few weeks, I stopped trying. I am who I am, and they could either like me or hate me. They hated me with a fucking vengeance. I started getting taunted, pushed around and beat up. I taunted back, matched every push with a push, every punch thrown with one of my own. Within a month or two, I had a reputation. Teachers talked about me, parents talked about me, the local cops talked about me. They did not say pleasant things. I responded by egging their houses, blowing up their mailboxes, and vandalizing their cars. I responded by declaring war on them and their town, and by fighting that war with everything inside of me. I didn't care whether I won or lost, I just wanted to fight. Bring it on, you motherfuckers. Bring everything you've got. I'm ready to fucking fight. 6 months into my time there, I became friends with a girl named Michelle. She was popular, beautiful, and smart. She played sports, and she was a cheerleader, and she got straight A's. I don't know why she wanted to be my friend, but she did. It started when she passed me a note in English class. The note said, "You don't seem as awful as I hear you are." I passed one back that read, "Beware, I am as awful as people say, and worse." She laughed, and I had a friend. She didn't become my ally, and I didn't ask her to or want her to, but she became my friend, and that was more than anyone else was willing to do. We started talking on the phone, passing notes in class, eating lunch together, riding in the same seat on the bus. People wondered why she bothered with me and wondered what she saw in me, and told her she shouldn't waste her time with me, but she ignored them. She had too much going for her for anyone to make her suffer for our friendship, so they pretended that it didn't exist. Halfway through the 8th grade, Michelle got asked out on a date by a guy in high school. She knew her parents wouldn't let her go, so she told them she was going to the movies with me. I had never done anything to them, and I had always been pleasant and polite in their presence, so they agreed and they drove us to the theater. I went inside and I watched the movie with a pint of whiskey, and I walked home by myself when it was over. Michelle got picked up and went on her date. She and the guy parked and drank beer, and as he was driving her back to the theater, he tried to beat a train across a set of tracks. His car got hit, and Michelle was killed. She was popular, beautiful, and smart. She played sports, and she was a cheerleader, and she got straight A's. She was my only friend. She got hit by a train and killed. She got hit by a fucking train and killed. I found out the next day. I got blamed by her parents and by their friends and by everyone else in that fucking hellhole. If she hadn't lied and if I hadn't helped her, it would not have happened. If we hadn't gone to the theater, she would not have gone on the date. The guy was unhurt and was a local football hero, and everyone felt sorry for him. I got taken down to the local police station and questioned. That was the way it worked there. Blame the fuck up, feel sorry for the football hero. Vilify one forever, forget the other had anything to do with it. I took a lot of punches for that bullshit, and every time I threw a punch back, and I threw one back every single time, I threw it back for her. I threw it back as hard as I fucking could, and I threw it back for her. I still think about Michelle, and I still miss her. I wish I could hear her voice, or hear her laugh, or see her smile. I wish I could sit next to her, or call her, or pass her a note. I wish I could smell her, touch her hair, look into her eyes. I wish I could hear her say, "Calm down, it's not worth it." I wish I could hear her say, "Walk away. Don't give them the pleasure." I wish I could hear her say, "It's okay, Jimmy. Everything is gonna be okay." I wish I could tell her I love her. Because I did. And I do. And I never did it when she was still alive. She was my only friend. She got hit by a train and killed. I don't believe she's in heaven. And I don't believe she's in a better place. She's dead. And when we're dead, we're gone. There are no blinding lights, there is no happy music, there are no angels waiting to greet us. St. Peter is not at the pearly gates with a big fat fucking book. Our friends and relatives are not holding a seat for us at some divine dinner table. We do not get a tour of heaven. We are dead, and that is it. No more. That does not, however, prevent me from talking to Michelle. I talk to her and I ask her questions and I tell her about my life. I tell her I miss her and I tell her that I think about her every day and I tell her that I love her. I tell her that I'm still throwing back and that I'm still throwing hard and that I'm still throwing for her. I will always throw for her. Always. I talk to Michelle and I tell her these things in the worst times of my life. I talk to Michelle and I tell her these things when I no longer have hope. I talk to Michelle and I tell her these things when I feel as if I'm going to die. I know that when I'm dead, I'll be dead. And I know that I'm close to death now. I know it is simple. And that when I die, there will be no more. I know I'll never meet Michelle in heaven or anywhere else. But I talk to her anyway. I've been talking to her a lot lately.
It's breakfast time. I make my way through the halls toward the dining hall. With each step I take, a profound need for a drink or something harder or both or everything grows on me. I walk through the glass corridor that separates the men and the women and I get in line. My need to get fucked up has grown exponentially. It has grown to the point that it is no longer a thought. There is just a base instinct. Get something. Fill me. Get something. Fill me. Someone bumps into me. The girl I met a few days ago is standing in front of me and she's dropped something. Her name is Lily. Fill me. I pick up whatever she dropped and I see it's a small piece of folded white paper. Get something. I hand it back to her. Fill me. She starts to say something. Get something. I ignore her. Fill me. I step forward. Get something. Fill me. I grab a tray and I ask the woman working behind the glass counter for eggs and bacon and sausage and pancakes and French toast. She doesn't give me enough, so I ask for more. She gives me another helping, but it's still not enough. I ask again. She says no, the plate won't hold anything else. I grab a stack of napkins and some silverware, and I find an empty table, and I tuck the napkins into the front of my shirt, and I sit down, and I get a bottle of syrup, and I cover the eggs and bacon and sausage and pancakes and French toast with the syrup, and I start devouring the food. I don't look at what it is, and I don't taste it, and I don't care what it is or what it tastes like. It doesn't matter. Get something. Fill me. I finish the plate. My face and my fingers and the napkins are covered with eggs and bacon and sausage and pancakes and French toast and syrup. I lick my fingers and I wipe my face and I pull the napkins out of the shirt and I ball them up and I drop them on my tray and I lick my fingers again. I want more, but for the moment, my needs have been met. I lean back in my chair. Leonard sits down at my table. He is wearing a different Rolex and a different Hawaiian shirt. His plate is covered with sausage and bacon and nothing else. Hey, kid, when'd you get the teeth? Yesterday. What did they have to do? Cap the outside tooth, fill a cavity on this one. I point to my outside left tooth. Root canals on these. I tap the middle two. They are firm. They give you good drugs? They didn't give me anything. No fucking way. Yeah. They didn't give you anything? No. You got root canals on your two front teeth without any drugs? Yeah. Leonard looks at me as if what I have said is incomprehensible to him. That's the worst fucking thing I've ever heard. It sucked. Sucked isn't the word I would use. It fucking sucked. He laughs, sets down his fork. Where the fuck did they make you, kid? What's that mean? Where does someone like you come from? Why do you care? Just wondering. Stop wondering. Why? I don't want to make friends here. Why? I don't like goodbyes. I stand and I take my tray and I get back in line and I get more food and I get more napkins and I make my way toward an empty table in the corner and I sit down and I eat my food. I eat slower this time. With each bite I take, I feel my stomach expanding. It is an awful, uncomfortable feeling, but I can't stop. I take bite after bite. I feel worse and worse. I look at the food, and I don't want any more, but it doesn't matter. I take bite after bite. I feel worse and worse. Get something. Fill me. That is all that matters. Fill me. I finish the plate, and I stand, and I walk slowly, slowly, slowly across the dining room, and I put my tray on the conveyor belt to the dishwasher. When I turn around, Lily is standing in front of me. Although I saw her a little while ago, I didn't really see her, and although I have met her twice before, I have never really looked at her. She has long black hair to the middle of her chest, and she has blue eyes. Not ice blue, water blue. Deep, clean water blue. She is pale white. Pale, pale, pale white. And her lips are thick and blood red, though she is not wearing lipstick. Her jeans are old and worn, and her black sweater is old and worn, and her combat boots are old and worn, and everything is too big for her body, which is small and thin. She is holding a tray and smiling. Her teeth are straight and white, and they are straight in a way that came without braces, and white in a way that has nothing to do with toothpaste. I smile back. She speaks.
You have teeth?
Yeah.
They look nice.
Thanks.
You doing all right?
Not even close.
You?
Yeah, I'm okay.
Good.
I step around her and I walk away. I know she is watching me, but I don't look back. Ken finds me and says the doctor is ready for me. He leads me to a small, clean, white examination room. Dr. Baker is sitting, holding a file. He stands when we enter.
Hi, James.
He offers his hand. I shake it.
Hello, Dr. Baker.
We sit.
Can I see your teeth?
I smile.
They look good. Dr. Stevens said you were very brave.
Dr. Stevens was good to me.
Thank him for me the next time you speak to him.
I will.
Now tell me why I'm here.
Dr. Baker opens his file.
I have the results from the tests we took a few days ago.
How bad is it?
He looks at the file. He takes a deep breath. He leans back in his chair and he looks at me.
He speaks.
You have done significant damage to your nose, your throat, your lungs, your stomach, your bladder, your kidneys, your liver, and your heart. I have never seen so much and such extensive damage in someone so young. We would need to do more tests to know the specific extent of it, and if you want them done, we can facilitate that. But from what I have here, I know a few important things. The first is that you're lucky to be alive. The second is that if you ever have another drink or use any type of hard drug again, there is a good chance that you will die. The third is that if you start drinking or using drugs regularly, you will be dead within a few days. Your body has suffered from a pattern of such profound and prolonged abuse that it will not hold up anymore.
Ken is staring at me. Dr. Baker is staring at me. I look past him and out the window where the storm is still raging. I finally know with absolute certainty what I have suspected for a long time. I am almost dead.
It's a happy fucking day.
Dr. Baker speaks.
This is not a joking matter, James.
I look at him.
I know it's not, but what the fuck am I supposed to say? I have received my sentence.
Ken speaks.
What's that mean?
What do you think it means?
We're here to help you, James. We're here to help you get better and to help you learn how to stop killing yourself. If you do what we tell you to do and you follow the program we prescribe, you will live a long and happy life.
I have received my sentence.
It doesn't have to be carried out. Just trust us.
I look at Dr. Baker.
You got anything else to say to me?
I hope you'll trust us. I hope you'll give us a chance to help you. And I hope to God you're here tomorrow.
I stare at him. His eyes are thick and wet and breaking. He is obviously sad and obviously disappointed. I'm tired of making people sad,
and I'm tired of disappointing them, and I'm tired of seeing them break. I have seen this too many times. He will be the last. I appreciate your time and your efforts. Both of you. Thank you. I stand and I open the door, and I walk out of the room and I shut the door behind me and I head back to my room. Although I have just been told that further use of alcohol and drugs is going to kill me, and kill me soon, what I want right now is a nice strong drink and a blast of rock. I want them badly. Get something. I want them so badly. Fill me. I would kill for them. Get something. Kill for them. Fill me. I am completely fucked. I walk back to my bed and I lie down and I close my eyes and the finality of Dr. Baker's words start to sink in and the words clear my mind and kill my urges and slow my heart. I have received my sentence. A few days of regular drug and alcohol abuse is going to kill me. I will be dead. Gone. No more. I will cease to exist in any way, shape, or form. I will meet the blackness, and the blackness will be eternal. Somehow I always knew I would meet my end this way. Somehow I always knew that I would kill myself with drugs and alcohol. I knew each time I took a drink. I knew each time I snorted a line. I knew each time I hit a pipe or sniffed a tube or took a pill. It's nobody's fault but my own. I knew each and every time. I could never stop. I can imagine my obituary. The truth of my existence will be removed and replaced with imagined good. The reality of how I lived will be avoided and changed, and phrases will be dropped in like beloved son, loving brother, reliable friend, hard-working student. People will change their view of me, from reckless fuck-up to helpless martyr, from dangerous fool to sad victim, from addicted asshole to unfortunate child. They will say things like, my God, what a waste. Oh, what he could have been. He had so much going for him. What happened? And it will be fucking false. Every single word of it will be false. I know who I am, and I know what I've done, and I know why I am about to die. I have faced the reality, and the reality is simple. I am an alcoholic, and I am a drug addict, and I am a criminal. That is what I am and who I am, and that is how I should be remembered. No happy lies, no invented memories, no fake sentimentality, no tears. I do not deserve tears. I deserve to be portrayed honestly, and I deserve nothing more, and I start to write an honest obituary in my own mind. I write the obituary that should appear, but never will. I start at the beginning, and I stick to the facts, and I move to what I know will be my end. James Fry, born in Cleveland, Ohio, September 12, 1969. Started stealing sips from drinks at 7. Got hammered for the first time at 10. Vomited from abuse for the first time at 10. Smoked dope at 12. By 13 was smoking and drinking regularly. Blacked out for the first time at 14. At 15 got arrested 3 times. For driving without a license, for vandalism and destruction of property, for public intoxication and possession of alcohol as a minor. Went to jail for a night. At 15 tried cocaine, acid, and crystal meth for the first time. Got arrested 3 more times at 16. Started drinking and doing drugs before school. Started selling liquor and drugs to his fellow students. Blacked out and vomited regularly. 3 more arrests at 17. Got first DUI. Blew a .36 and set a county record. Went to jail for a week. Drank and did drugs every day. At school, at home, everywhere. Vomited and blacked out several times a week. Made first attempt to quit. Experienced delirium tremens. Drank to make them go away. 2 arrests at 18. First drug overdose. First case of alcohol poisoning. Tried to quit again. Lasted 2 days. Vomited blood for the first time. Had first cocaine-induced bloody nose. 19. Blacked out 5 days a week. Vomited 5 days a week. Pissed bed for the first time. shook visibly when not drinking. Woke up for the first time without knowing where he was or how he got there. 20. Blacked out 7 days a week. Vomited several times a day, 7 days a week. Smoked cocaine for the first time. Smoked methamphetamine for the first time. Smoked PCP for the first time. 21. 3 arrests. Assault with a deadly weapon. Assaulting an officer of the law. Felony DUI. Resisting arrest. Attempted incitement of a riot. Possession of a narcotic with intent to distribute. Felony mayhem. Skipped bail on everything. Smoked crack for the first time. Started smoking crack regularly. 1 overdose. 3 cases of alcohol poisoning. 22. Accelerated alcohol abuse. Accelerated crack abuse. Took anything and everything possible, whenever possible. Was constantly sick. Vomiting and shitting blood daily. Tried to quit 4 times. Never lasted longer than 12 hours. 23. Continued acceleration of abuse. Continued decline in health. 2 overdoses. Constant alcohol poisoning. Rarely knew where he was or how he got there. Tried to quit 2 times. Lasted a total of 6 hours. Fell down fire escape and destroyed face. Checked into treatment center. Left treatment center. Died 2 days later. Fatal dosage levels of alcohol and cocaine found in system. Death ruled accidental overdose. Should have been ruled suicide. Intentional suicide. He is survived by no one. His family had written him off. His friends had written him off. My mind is clear, and my urges are gone, and my heart is beating slow and steady. I am going to leave here, and I am going to kill myself. The thought makes me smile. It makes me smile because it is sad and horrible. It makes me smile because the mystery of my death is gone, and without the mystery, it isn't scary anymore. It makes me smile because I would rather smile than cry. It makes me smile because it's going to be over. It is finally going to be over. It is finally going to be over. Thank you. I take a deep breath and I wonder how many breaths I have left. I feel my heart beat and I wonder how many more. I run my hands along my body and my body is warm and soft and I know that soon it will be cold and hard. I feel my hair, my eyes, my nose, my lips. I feel the whiskers growing on my cheeks. I touch the skin on my neck, my chest, my arms. It will all be rotting soon. Decomposing and disintegrating. Disappearing. Every trace will cease to exist. Ashes to ashes. Dust to dust. We return from which we came. I will be rotting and decomposing and disintegrating soon. At lunch, I eat with Leonard. He asks me a lot of questions, and I don't answer any of them. He thinks it's funny, and I think it's funny. And at a certain point, he gives up and he tells me stories about our fellow patients. They are all the same. Had it all, got fucked up, lost it all. Trying to recover. The great American sob story. After lunch, we go to the lecture, which is about exercise and sobriety. I don't listen to a single word of it, don't care one fucking bit. And Leonard throws pennies at the bald man who is now my roommate. He aims for his head, and he gets excited whenever he hits the center of the bald spot on the top of the man's skull. For some reason, the man tolerates it. The lecture ends, and we go back to the unit, and I attend my first group therapy session. The topic is amends. The group is led by Ken, and they discuss the necessity of making amends. Ken believes they are imperative, as do most of the men in the group. Making them allows one to start with a clean slate. To get rid of the guilt addicts accrue with their actions, to shed the skin of their previous life. Whether they are accepted or not isn't important. What is important is the act of apologizing, the act of admitting fault, the act of asking for forgiveness. The men who don't believe in amends are the worst of the group. They know that most of what they have done shouldn't be forgiven and won't be forgiven, They don't want to make the effort of asking, because the pain of rejection and the reminder of their actions will hurt too much. They want to move on and forget, even though forgetting is impossible. I am in their class. I know I won't be forgiven, and I'm not going to bother to ask. My amends will be my death. No one I have hurt will ever have to see me, hear from me, or think about me ever again. I won't be able to damage them or fuck up their lives anymore. I won't be able to cause them the pain I have caused previously. Forget me if you can. Forget I ever existed. Forget I did whatever it was I did. My suicide will be my apology. Even though it is impossible, please forget me. Please forget. After the group, all of the men of the unit gather in the lower level, and there is a graduation ceremony. Roy and his friend are both leaving. They have done their time, worked their programs, and they are ready to rejoin the outside world. They both receive a medal and a rock. The medal signifies their current term of sobriety. The rock, their resolve to stay sober. They both give small speeches. About half of the men despise them and think they're full of shit. The other half admire them and wish them the best. I sit in the back of the room with Leonard, who reads the USA Today sports page and swears under his breath. The ceremony ends, and everybody claps, and Roy walks around giving out hugs and goodbyes. He avoids me, as does his friend. They both seem very happy, and they both have the glazed eyes of the converted. They both look scared, and they both look fragile. They both look as if they're running from something, and they both look as if they're hiding from something. They both look as if they know they're going to get caught. I give them a month before they're both so fucked up that they can't see straight. I give them a month at best. I walk to the dining hall, and I get in line, and I grab a tray, and I take a deep breath, and the smell of the food floods my body, and I am hungry, 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 and I want to eat, and I want to eat a lot. Tonight's meal is meatloaf and mashed potatoes and gravy and Brussels sprouts and apple pie. It is a meal I like, and it is suitable for what will probably be the last real meal that I eat. I get as much as the woman behind the counter will give me, and I get utensils and napkins, and I find an empty table, and I sit down, and I spread the napkins on my lap, and I take a deep breath. This is probably going to be the last real meal I ever eat. I finish eating, and I lean back in my chair, and I see Leonard walking toward me with a tray of food. He sets down his tray on the table, and he sits across from me. How are you, kid? I'm good.
You're good?
Yeah, I'm good.
It's the first time I ever heard you say that.
I'm coming to terms with some shit.
What?
None of your business.
One of these days you're going to talk to me.
No, I'm not.
You'll get tired of being an asshole, and you'll get tired of not having any friends, and you'll talk to me.
No, I won't.
I'm going to keep sitting with you until you do.
I laugh.
I'm going to keep sitting with you. Mark my motherfucking words.
I grab my tray. Stand. Have a nice life, Leonard.
What's that supposed to mean?
Have a nice life. I turn and I walk my tray to the conveyor and I drop it on the belt and I walk out of the dining hall. At the next lecture, I find a seat in the back row and I sit down and I stare straight ahead and I ignore everything and everyone around me. In 15 minutes, I'll be out of here. Gone for good on a beeline to hell. In the simplest terms, what I'm doing shouldn't be hard. Stand up, walk out, keep walking. The abstract, however, is starting to sink in. The abstract is starting to sink in, and it is starting to make this harder for me. I am going to die. When I die, I will be dead. Gone. No more. There will be no more thinking, no more breathing, no more feeling of any kind. There will be blackness, and the blackness will be eternal. There will be silence, and the silence will last forever. I am going to die. I take a deep breath. I am doing the right thing. I am doing the right thing. I am doing the right thing. It is time to end this charade. It is time for me to leave. I can't take my life anymore. I can't take myself anymore. I can't look into my own eyes. I can't bear to face my own image. I have tried to get better, and I can't. It is time for me to die. Leonard sits down next to me, and he stares at me. I stare straight ahead.
Why are you wearing that big coat?
I ignore him.
You cold?
I ignore him.
Why are you wearing that big coat?
He stares.
Talk to me, you little fucker.
I stare straight ahead.
Why are you wearing that big coat?
I ignore him. He reaches for me and he puts his hand on my shoulder and he shakes me.
Why'd you tell me to have a nice life?
I remove his hand from my shoulder and I forcefully set it in his lap and I turn and I look him in the eye. Leave me the fuck alone. He looks back, right in my eye.
Why did you tell me to have a nice life?
Leave me alone, old man. Leave me the fuck alone. I turn away from him and I stare straight ahead. I can feel him continue to stare at me. I don't know why he's doing this or why he cares or what he thinks it is going to achieve. If he tries to stop me, I will prevent him from doing so and I will leave anyway. It is time for me to die. The lecture starts and he turns away from me. On the stage, a man about my own age starts telling his life story. He drank some beer and he smoked some pot as a kid, and he got sober when he was 14. He joined AA and he found a higher power and it changed his life. He got straight A's in high school and he went to Harvard. Now he's an investment banker and he's engaged to be married. He still goes to meetings, places all of his trust in his higher power, and he gets down on his knees every night and he prays before he goes to bed. As he speaks of his nefarious past, he refers to pot as grass and beer as brew. He talks about having the spins and taking sips from a flask at a school dance. He talks about the guilt and shame he felt in committing these acts. I do not relate to this man in any way whatsoever. I stand and I start to make my way out of the aisle. As I pass Leonard, he reaches for my arm. I push his hand away and I keep going, past the rest of the seated men, toward the door, out and into a hall, toward another door that leads outside. I reach the door and I open it, and I am hit by the cold and the rain and the wind and the sleet, and I am hit by the darkness, and I am hit by what lives within the darkness. I button up the jacket and I flip the collar and I take a deep breath and I stare into the black. They are waiting for me. The drink and the drugs and the dealers and the addicts and the criminals and the whores and the pimps and the killers and the slaves and the pipes and the bottles and the smoke and the vomit and the blood and the human rot and the human decay and the human disintegration. They are there in the darkness and they are waiting for me. I step out from beneath the cover of the door and I start walking. One step at a time, away, away, away. The cold is quick and bitter. The rain and sleet are hard and wet. The ground a mosaic of mud and rock and water. The darkness, the darkest darkness. Away, 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 one step at a time. It is waiting for me. It is waiting for me. About 20 feet from the entrance, I hear the door open and I turn around and I see Leonard coming outside. He's not wearing a jacket, and he's immediately drenched, and he is heading straight toward me.
Hey, kid!
I turn away from him, and I keep walking. I hear his footsteps in the wetness, and I hear the pace of them increase, and I hear them getting closer to me. I keep walking.
Wait up a second, kid. Where are you going?
A hand on my shoulder. I push it off.
Stop for a second, kid.
A hand on my shoulder. I push it off. Hands on both my shoulders. Stronger than I expected. They stop me and they turn me around. Leonard is drenched and dripping. He speaks.
Where are you going?
I push his arms off of me. Leave me alone. I start walking.
Where are you going?
He follows me. Away from here.
What are you gonna do?
Get fucked up.
No way I'm letting that happen.
You think you're going to stop me?
Yeah.
I stop, turn around, grab him by the throat, squeeze his Adam's apple. I don't want him following me. Don't want him trying to stop me. I am in the darkest darkness. I am going home. Leave me alone, old man. I let go, push him to the ground. He grabs his throat, gags. I start walking and the lights of the clinic start to fade and the black begins to envelop me. I hear Leonard stand and start after me again and I clench my fists and prepare to use more persuasive means to stop him.
I can see the fist, kid, and it's gonna take a whole lot more than that to take me down.
I keep walking.
And even if you can take me down, I'll have you found and brought back here.
He follows.
And I'll keep doing it as many times as you leave and as many times as it takes to get your goddamn head on straight and make you start fixing yourself.
I keep walking.
You don't know me and you don't know who I am, but I have the resources and I'll fucking use them. I'll bring you back again and again and again.
I stop and I turn around. He's a few feet behind me. He stops and he stares at me.
Again and again and again, kid. I'll keep doing it.
I told you to leave me alone.
Come back inside.
No.
Where are you gonna go?
I'm gonna go get fucked up.
And then what?
I'll see what happens.
You'll end up dead.
Maybe.
When you're dead, you're dead.
I know.
There's no coming back.
I know that.
That's not what you want.
It's my only option.
No, it's not.
He steps forward. One more step and I'll drop you.
I'll get back up.
No, you won't.
What are you scared of, kid?
Fuck you.
He steps forward. What are you scared of?
Take a step back, old man.
He stares at me. I stare at him.
He steps back and he speaks.
I'm not scared of anyone,
and you scare the shit out of me.
Ed and Ted won't eat with me anymore because they're worried that you might snap on them. And all day, all anybody talked about was how you stared Lincoln down and laughed in his face when he tried to get rough with you. As much as I admire it in a certain sense, it's no good being the way you are. It's no good at all.
I am what I am.
That's not what's inside of you.
Fuck you.
You can't fool me.
Fuck you.
You can't fool me.
Fuck you.
Fine. Fuck me. Go find some booze and whatever else it is you do and get fucked up and go die in the gutter with piss on your pants and shit in your drawers. That's a good way to go, kid. An honorable way out. Be proud.
It's my choice.
If you think you're making that choice, you're wrong. Your choices are made by the shit that controls you and by the shit you can't quit. You walk out of here and that shit's gonna kill you and that's fucking wrong.
Maybe. Maybe not.
Maybe not my ass. How about walking back in and being a fucking man? How about walking back in and putting up a fucking fight? How about walking back in and doing what's decent and right and honorable and showing a little pride? Just a little bit of fucking pride.
Not possible.
Why?
It's just not.
You're strong enough to get your teeth drilled without drugs, and you're strong enough to scare the shit out of a bunch of hardened fuck-ups, and you're strong enough to do whatever the fuck you've had to do to end up like you are, and you can't walk back into that clinic and try?
No.
Why?
I've tried before. I can't do it.
Why?
It's too hard.
Life is hard, kid. You gotta be harder. You gotta take it on and fight for it and be a fucking man about how you live it. If you're too much of a pussy to do that, then maybe you should leave, cause you're dead already.
I stare at him and he stares back. Unlike most of the eyes that look upon me, there is no pity in his, no sadness, no sense that he's looking at a lost cause. There is an anger, and there is a hardness, and there is a resolve. There is truth, and that is all that matters. The truth. I don't know why he's out here or why he's doing this, but I know by his eyes that he means what he says, and he will follow through with his words. Why do you give a shit? Because I do. Why?
It doesn't matter why.
All that matters is that I'm here and that I'm not going to accept any of your bullshit or any of your excuses. You can make this easy and come back right now, or you can make this hard and make me call out my dogs. Either way, you're here till you get better.
I can't promise that's going to happen. Promise that you'll try.
I stare at him.
Trying can't hurt, kid.
There is truth in his eyes. Truth is all that matters.
And trying's nothing to be scared of.
Truth. Just try. I take a deep breath. I stare at him. I am in the darkest darkness and I am comfortable. Except for my time inside, I have been sober for a total of 4 days in the last 6 years. My attempts at sobriety were weak at best. There was always liquor around. There were always drugs around. I was always around people who were using them. I am profoundly, physically, mentally, and emotionally addicted to 2 separate substances. I am profoundly, physically, mentally, and emotionally addicted to a certain way of life. I don't know anything else anymore. I don't remember anything else anymore. I don't know if I can be anything else at this point. I am scared to try. I am fucking scared to death to try. I have considered my options to be jail or death. I have never considered quitting to be an option because I have never believed that I could do it. I am scared to death to try. I stare at Leonard. I don't know him. I don't know who he is or what he does or what he has done to arrive at this moment. I don't know why he is here or why he has followed me or why he gives a shit. What I know is in his eyes. What I know is an anger, a hardness, a resolve, and truth. What I know is that I respect his eyes, and I believe his eyes. What I know is that what's in his eyes is different from any of the other eyes that have looked at me, judged me, pitied me, and written me off over the last years. What I know is that I can trust his eyes, because what lives in them lives in me. 24 hours.
24 hours what?
I'll stay here for 24 hours. If I feel the same way I feel now, I'm gone.
I'll call out my dogs.
Call them. I'll bite their fucking heads off. He smiles.
You're a scary motherfucker, kid.
Don't forget it, old man. He laughs.
Come here. I'm gonna give you a hug.
I stay where I am. I agreed to 24 hours. That doesn't mean I'm hugging you, and that doesn't mean we're friends. He laughs again, steps forward, puts his arms around me, hugs me.
All you got to do is try.
I pull away. He motions toward the faded lights of the clinic.
It's fucking cold out here, and I'm soaking wet, and I don't want to get sick. Let's go inside.
I'm not going back to that lecture.
I don't care if you do or you don't. As long as you're inside, I'm happy.
We walk back to the door and I open it and we go inside. The lights are bright and I don't like them and I am scared to death. I am scared to death. Scared to death. Scared. Fucking scared. I go to bed, but I don't sleep. Darkness retreats and the sun rises. I step into the shower and I turn on the hot water. Same old bullshit. The water burns and it turns my skin red and it hurts and I stand there and I take it because I deserve it. I step out and I dry off and I walk to the mirror and I wipe the steam away and I look at myself. The black beneath my eyes is fading. The swelling around my nose is gone, though the bump is there and will stay there. The swelling in my lips is down, and my lips are starting to look almost normal. The reduced swelling in them makes the stitches around my gash more prominent. The stitches are old and black and crusty, and they look like barbed wire. The gash has sealed itself, and a scar is starting to form. I pull down my lower lip to look at the rest of the cuts and the rest of the stitches. The stitches are black, and they weave in and out of one another like a vicious fence. The cuts are closed bright white against pale red. They're no longer bleeding, no longer oozing, and scars are starting to form. I start to look up. I want to see my eyes. I want to look beneath the surface of the pale green and see what's inside of me. As I get near, I turn away. I try to force myself back, but I can't do it. I have not consciously looked into my eyes for years. Although I have wanted to look into them, I have not had the strength to do so. I try to force myself, but I can't. I do not have the strength now, and I do not know if I will ever have the strength. I might never look into the pale green of my eyes again. There are places from which you cannot return. There is damage that can be irreparable. I get some nail clippers and I remove my stitches. I get dressed. I clean the toilets. I walk to the dining hall. I see Leonard walking toward me and I set down my fork and he's smiling. And he looks as if he didn't expect to see me here and he waves at me. I give him the finger and as he sits down he laughs at me.
Good to see you still here.
Got 14 more hours.
You keeping track?
Part of me is.
Which part?
The part that'll kick your ass if you try to stop me again.
It'll take more than an ass-kicking for me not to stop you.
Why is that?
Because I can take an ass-kicking.
I mean, why do you give a shit?
I just do.
Why?
That's none of your concern right now.
You try to control me, try to tell me what I can and can't do, I consider that my concern.
You're looking at it the wrong way, kid. I'm just trying to help you.
Why?
Leonard leans back in his chair.
Are we friends?
No. He chuckles.
You want to hear a story that I might tell someone who was a friend?
If it'll explain why you won't leave me alone. He chuckles again, stares at me for a moment, speaks.
I grew up in the Bronx, just off Arthur Avenue, which is a working-class Italian neighborhood. My pop mowed lawns and polished shoes at a fancy country club in Westchester to pay our bills, and my mom stayed home and took care of me. We didn't have any dough, but we loved each other and we had a good life together. When I was 11, my pop got hit by a cement truck as he was walking across the street and he died. My mom was heartbroken. 2 months later, she got hit by a subway train. The authorities called it an accident, said she slipped or something. But I knew better. My mom just couldn't survive without my dad, and she went to find him. I had to live in an orphanage, which was awful. Nobody there gave two shits about me. I started skipping school and following this guy around my neighborhood whose name was Michelangelo, but who was better known as Mikey the Nose. I thought Mikey was a god. He drove a caddy, always had a blonde riding shotgun, and he carried a huge wad of cash in his pocket. He did good things for people in the neighborhood who needed them done. He paid their rent, gave them coats and hats and gloves in the winter, delivered food to people who were hungry. I knew he did bad shit, too, but I was too young to understand what might be involved in that. One day at one of his stops, Michelangelo got out of his car and came up to me and asked me why the fuck I followed him around all the time. I was so scared I couldn't talk. He asked again, and this time he added that he wasn't going to hurt me. He just wanted to know. I told him it was because I wanted to figure out what he did and do it myself so I wouldn't have to live in the orphanage anymore. He laughed, and he asked me my name. And I told him, and he said, following me around all the time is stupid. If you want to see what I'm doing, come ride with me tomorrow. So the next day, instead of a blonde riding shotgun, there was me. And that's all I did from that point on. Ride around with Michelangelo and learn what he did for a living. A couple of months after that, I left the orphanage and moved in with him. I don't think anyone noticed I was gone. A year later, Michelangelo got married to a woman named Gina, who was the greatest woman that I have ever known. I lived with them just like I was their son, though I figured once they had kids, I'd be gone. Turned out Gina couldn't have kids, so they asked me if I might want to stay with them permanently. I said yes. Michelangelo pulled some strings, and he and Gina adopted me. And for the rest of my childhood, they treated me like I was their real son. They gave me a life. They gave me a home. They gave me a future. And they gave me love. They gave me lots and lots of love. Leonard stops speaking, looks down at the table.
I wait for him to start again, but he doesn't. I speak. That's a very touching story, Leonard. Very sweet and tender. He looks up at me. But I'm not a kid, and I'm not an orphan, and I don't want to be your fucking project. You understand me? He smiles. You need help, kid. Find someone else, Leonard. You like football? Find someone else. I heard you. I understood you. I'm changing the subject. You like football? Yeah. Who's your team?
The Cleveland Browns.
Really?
Yeah.
Why the Browns?
I was born in Cleveland.
He nods. They're playing Pittsburgh today. Should be a good game. You want to watch it with me?
Not if it's part of your project.
It's not.
Then maybe.
You got plans?
No.
Then watch with me.
We'll see. When I'm done eating, I stand and I take my tray and I drop it on the conveyor and I walk back to the unit. On the lower level, men are gathering around the television watching a pre-game football show. Some of them are smoking, some of them are drinking coffee, some of them seem excited, some of them seem bored out of their fucking skulls. No matter what they are doing, no matter what their attitude may be, they are staring at the images on the screen. Addictions need fuel. Sometimes anything, even base images on a dull screen, will do. Fuel. I have 13.5 hours left. I get a cup of coffee, and I find a place on a couch, and I light a cigarette, and I watch the football show. I don't really know what the men on the show are saying, and I doubt they do either. But they seem to think it's important, so I try to pay attention. Within a couple of minutes, I am almost catatonic. I stare at the screen. I drink my coffee. I smoke my cigarettes. I don't even try to figure out what the fuck the guys on the screen are talking about. Leonard walks in with the bald man and hollers, "I am open for business," and men start placing bets with him, and the bald man writes down the bets on a small pad, and he takes the money for the bets, and he places it in a small bag with a large zipper. At one point, Lincoln walks through the room, and all the activity stops. When he's gone, it starts again. Men without money bet cigarettes or their job duties. One man bets a pair of slippers. Another bets his sunglasses. Addictions need fuel. The television isn't enough. When the games start, the men argue over which game we're going to watch, and the argument ends when Leonard says we're watching the Pittsburgh-Cleveland game. Nobody wants to watch the Pittsburgh-Cleveland game, and there is a volley of complaints, but Leonard says the decision is final, and everyone shuts up and turns their attention to the screen. When I was a child, my father always had season tickets to the Browns. Although he could have used them for business, he never did. Each Sunday in the fall, he and my brother and I would put on Browns jerseys and Browns hats and take the train downtown from our house in the suburbs and walk from the train to the stadium. My dad held our hands the whole way, and because he had only two seats, he'd carry me into the game and I'd watch it from his lap. We'd yell and scream and cheer and sing songs when the Browns won. We'd cry when they lost. When I got too old to be carried into the stadium, my brother and I would alternate games. One week him, one week me. If my dad was out of town, my mom would take us. I loved the motherfucking Browns as a kid, and although I haven't watched football in a long time, part of me still does. I loved my family as a kid, and although I haven't in a long time, the same part of me that still loves the Browns and the same part of me that remains human and the same part of me that remembers what love is still loves them as well. I sit and I silently watch the game and I relive the memories of the games I attended with my mother and my father and my brother. Around me, men cheer and yell according to their bets. One man complains about having to watch Cleveland-Pittsburgh. And he calls Cleveland the mistake on the lake, and he says that it is the shittiest city he's ever seen, and that it's full of the shittiest people he's ever had the displeasure of encountering. And he yaps endlessly about how pissed he is that he has to watch a crap team from a crap city, and on and on and on. After about half an hour, The memories and the love disappear, and I lean over and I stare at him until he turns to me, and I tell him that if he doesn't pipe down, the only mistake spoken of today will be the fact that he couldn't shut his fat fucking mouth. Part of me still loves. More of me doesn't. Lunch rolls around, and most of the men go to the dining hall, and they get sandwiches, and they bring them back, and they continue to watch football on the television. As I get ready to do the same, Ted walks up to me and tells me that someone from administration is looking for me, and that I'm wanted at the front desk. I ask him if he knows why, and he tells me he has no idea. I get up, and I go to the front desk, and I tell the receptionist my name. She smiles, and she tells me that I have visitors, and she leads me through a short hall toward a door. They're in there. Who are they? They asked me not to tell you. Thank you. She walks away, and I stare at the door, and I take a deep breath. I do not look forward to seeing people from my past. They rarely have kind things to say to me, and I have always done something to deserve their disdain. I take a deep breath, and I open the door, and I hear laughing, and the laughing stops, and I step into the room, and my brother is sitting at a table with a couple of formerly close friends of mine who live together in Minneapolis. My brother stands.
What's up, buddy?
I smile. Nothing. He hugs me, and I hug him back. It feels good.
What are you doing here?
We separate.
It's visiting day. I wouldn't miss visiting day.
I turn to my friends. Their names are Julie and Kirk.
What are you guys doing here?
Julie smiles.
We wouldn't miss visiting day either.
I smile. Thanks. Kirk stands and he hugs me, and Julie follows him, and we separate. There are a number of wrapped packages on the table. My brother motions toward them.
It's time for you to open your presents.
I sit.
You bring me these?
I brought a couple, and they brought a couple. I look to Julie and Kirk. I didn't think you'd ever speak to me again after last time. Kirk laughs.
People do stupid things when they're fucked up. We don't ever need to talk about it again.
Thank you. He pushes forward a box. Now open. The box is beautifully wrapped. The paper is bright and colorful, and it says "Get Well Soon," and has a ribbon around it. I open it slowly and carefully, and I almost wish I didn't have to open it at all. It would be nice just to carry it around. Beneath the paper, there is a plain cardboard box. I open the box, and inside of it, there are three small wrapped packages. I pull them out, and I look at Kirk and Julie.
You really didn't have to do this.
Julie smiles.
We wanted to.
I smile, and I look at the packages, and I start to open them, and I have to stop myself from crying. I do not deserve this kindness. I do not deserve it. Inside the packages, there is a pair of wool slippers, two cartons of cigarettes, a box of chocolates. I look at Julie and Kirk, and I thank them, and my voice cracks, and they smile, and my brother pushes his boxes forward, and they're not as perfectly wrapped, but they're beautiful as well. I open them, and there are two pair of khakis, and two pairs of wool socks, and two white t-shirts, and two pairs of boxer shorts, and a black wool sweater, and a pair of pajamas, and a black ball cap with the Cleveland Browns logo on the front. There is a toothbrush, and some toothpaste, and some shampoo, and some soap, and a can of shaving cream, and a razor. There are some books. I stare at all of my presents, and I try to speak, but I can't. I look up at my brother. He's smiling.
You like everything?
Yeah.
You need anything else?
No, this is great. I stand and I walk to my brother and I lean over and I give him a hug and I whisper thank you in his ear and I do the same with Julie and Kirk and I gather up my things and I walk toward the door.
You want me to show you around?
They stand. My brother speaks.
That'd be great.
It's not great. But it is a tour. I just like having them with me. Time goes quickly. At the front entrance, I step outside with them to say goodbye. Thanks for coming. It means a lot to me. Julie speaks.
We were worried about you.
I don't want you to worry about me. Kirk speaks. We will anyway. You shouldn't. Bob speaks. We want you to get better, buddy. I know you do. This place is your only option. There are others. What? I think you know what they are. Bob puts his hand on my shoulder, stares at me. Get better. Please get better. He starts to break, and seeing him start to break makes me start to break, and I don't want that. He steps forward, and he puts his arms around me, and he hugs me, and I hug him, and it feels good and strong and pure and real. This is my brother, my blood, the only thing in this world created from that which I was created from, the person in this world who knows me best, the person who would miss me most if I was gone. That he cared enough to come here, and that he cares enough to nearly break in front of me means something. But in the end, I know that it means only so much. We separate, and he pushes me in the way that brothers push each other. I don't want you to die, you dumb little fucker. I push him back. I hear you. Let's leave it at that. He nods, and he knows me well enough to know that that's all he's going to get. I hug Julie and Kirk, and I thank them for the gifts and the visit, and they tell me they'll be back next week, and they tell me that if I need anything I should call them, and I thank them again. They walk toward their car. I go back inside. I call my parents. My mother answers the phone, and she accepts the call. James? She sounds frantic. Hi, Mom. Let me get your father. She holds the phone away, yells for my father. He picks up. How are you, James? I'm fine, Dad. You're doing okay? I'm fine. My mother speaks.
Are you getting better?
I don't know.
Do you feel any better?
I don't know.
Are you learning anything?
I don't know. She exhales frustration. My father speaks. James?
Yeah?
Your mom and I have been talking to some of the counselors up there, and we want to come see you.
No.
Why?
Because I don't want you here.
Why?
Because I don't.
My mother speaks.
They have something called the family program where we would spend 3 days learning about your sickness and learning about how to help you deal with it. We'd like to come do it.
My sickness?
Alcoholism and drug addiction is a disease, James.
Who told you that?
It's in all the books.
Right. The books. There is an uncomfortable pause. Father speaks.
We'd really like to do the program, James. We think it could be really good for all of us.
I don't want you here, and if you come, I'll be fucking pissed. My mother speaks.
Could you please not swear?
I'll try. Another uncomfortable pause. I speak. Go back to Tokyo. I'll call you next week to tell you how I'm doing. My father speaks.
We're very worried about you, James.
I hear my mother start to cry.
I know you are.
We really want to come up there.
Cry.
Do what you want, but don't expect me to participate if you do.
Do you need anything?
Cry.
I need to go.
We love you, James.
I know you do.
My mother speaks.
I love you, James.
Her voice breaks. I know you do, Mom. My father speaks.
Call us if we can help in any way.
I've got to go, Dad.
Please reconsider the family program.
Bye, Dad.
Bye, James.
My mother sobs.
Bye, James.
Bye, Mom. My mother sobs.
We love you.
I've got to go. I hang up the phone and I take a deep breath and I stare at the floor. My mother and father are at a house in Michigan that I've never